that tile. Isn't it a knobby one and just the proper style? I should like to have one just the same as that. Wherever I go, they shout, hello, where did you get that hat?
Now, hello and welcome to the Shropshire Witches podcast. And today we are looking at something slightly different, but nevertheless incredibly fascinating and interesting. So we are going to be looking at the wonderful, exuberant world of music halls. And I can promise you, we have got a little bit of an expert here in the form of our very own Alex. So I cannot wait to find out more and do a bit of a deep dive into the world of music halls.
Thank you so much. I'm sitting here smiling in the sort of cheesiest way because I am ecstatic that we're doing musical. And I bet when you did that fantastic intro, they thought, oh my gosh, they've got a guest on. No, it's just me. I'm sorry. Anticlimax. But I'm so excited about this. And just now, before we sort of start recording things, we're having a good chat about this. And we're kind of covering different bases about what we're going to talk about. But I was just explaining to you, Amy, that my kind of passion for the music hall goes way back to childhood, when on the farm, my grandmother's sheets would be hanging on the washing line. And we would use them, my sisters and I, as stage curtains and things like that. And I always had to be like the kind of Mary Lloyd, like, you know, or Vesta Tilly, like one of the girls that dressed as a boy or sung sort of like bawdy songs. I used to just sing Any Old Iron and things like that. But we would use the sheets and stage curtains and sort of burst on and put on what was frankly probably quite a crap show. We thought we were sort of like, you know, in some kind of Whitechapel musical. We thought we were great, you know, equipped with a very, very dodgy Mockney accent as well. But I think the reason I kind of say that is because I think that with the music hall, we're gonna talk about different elements of this, and we're also gonna talk about its kind of inception and where it comes from, because it didn't just happen overnight. And in fact, even modern things like karaoke, whether you love or hate it, stems from the music hall. And there are still entertainers today that very much have the music hall persona, and we still have the Royal Variety performance. So music hall is still there. And of course, a lot of the songs that come from music hall, like Daisy Bell, so, you know, Daisy, Daisy, and you know, Where Did You Get That Hat, Any Old Iron, all these old songs are still like, I mean, maybe not so much with Gen Z, perhaps, so then maybe they'll die with the millennials, but they're still in the vernacular to the point that a lot of us had to sing it at primary school and things like this. So even though a lot of these songs are over 100 years old, they're still familiar and they still have this nostalgic feel. And what I find so enchanting about the music hall as well is that the second you say it, it kind of just instantly creates this image. You've got these kind of gaslit theatres. You've got this kind of, you know, as you explained before we recorded, Amy, which we'll talk a bit more about as well, but these kind of bawdy shows. You've got men kind of slapping their hands on the tables and cigars smoking, booze, you know, this kind of very vivid, colourful image of what the music hall was. And of course, there's other realities as an aside to that, but it really was this kind of pinnacle of entertainment for a lot of people for really the best part of probably 100 years. And its glory days were certainly in the 19th century, and it had less salubrious beginnings and then went into something that even royalty attended. And in fact, Edward VII famously had mistresses from the music hall as well. And Vesta Tilly actually went on to marry an aristocrat, and that was not that unusual. So these things did happen, and I just think it's just got this affection in our hearts. And I'm just, in short, very excited to talk about it tonight. So, what do you want to do first? Do you want to do a bit of a Shropshire focus first? Do you want to what should we start with?
Yeah, so we can go into Shropshire. So it's worth knowing that there are music halls in some variety all over Shropshire. So, for example, where I grew up in Madeley, there was a building called the Anstice, which was kind of a music hall and other things. So, for example, it was created through public subscription, and the Anstice family, which are quite a prominent family in the area, they paid for it in around 1870. But it did have the capacity as a music hall, but also slightly other things as well. And then in a later date, it was kind of like somewhere where you would go dancing and meet someone. But I've chosen specifically to look at Shrewsbury. And Some of the buildings in Shrewsbury, two of the buildings, in fact, that had some, as part of their history, was a music hall. So the first one was the Shrewsbury Music Hall. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're familiar with Shrewsbury now, today, you'd know it as the Museum of Art and History in the square. But it started its life in 1840 as a music hall, and on the 14th of November it was kind of your opening night. I always think of things like with opening nights of like the Muppet Show with and then my brain starts going off on a tangent, but the idea of all the lights and the glamour and the glitz of the Muppet Show was the opening night on the 14th of November 1840, and they opened with a series of grand promenade concerts.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite sure the details, but the Herefordshire Journal reported briefly on the opening of the hall in their edition, saying the opening of the music hall in Shrewsbury was celebrated by a music festival which took place on Tuesday and Wednesday last. Several of the most eminent vocal and instrumental performers of the present day gratified the numerous auditory by the exercise of their talents, and total proceeds of the festival. And then it goes on. And I love whenever you're reading Victorian accounts of anything, the absolute word vomit. The it's paid by the word, isn't it? It's word, oh, I could say it in five, but here's 35. Yeah. So it started off very humble. There was some grand performances going on there, but it was very much when I looked in the newspaper archives, there wasn't much of a explanation or hoo-ha about it opening.
Mm-hmm.
But the building beforehand, which is rather interesting, actually it was completely redeveloped, and it's very classical in style. You've got the stone columns that are outside even today and the sash windows. But before that, it was a medieval mansion.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So it dates back to around 1290. I can't find a specific date, but it's around the 1200s, and it was Vaughan's mansion. And it's quite interesting because when I was researching it, it said that there's only actually a handful of these kind of urban stone townhouses left in the country.
Hmm.
And Vaughan's was the only one to be found in Shropshire. And it was originally the home of William Vaughan. And William Vaughan was, I couldn't find too much about him, but he was a local merchant and he was one of the wealthiest men in the town. So it started off its life as this very status building, this very wealthy symbol of status. And when you go, if you do, which I completely recommend a visit to the museum now,
oh, yeah,
you can still see some of the original medieval building and the medieval kind of architecture. So it's well worth a visit. It's a fascinating building. And throughout its history, it had various different guises over the centuries, most recently being a museum. But it also became, in different parts of its life, an art academy, a Freemasons hall. There's, interestingly, supposedly, bunkers, Cold War bunkers in the cellars of the building. Wow. Yeah, which were meant to be for in the event of a Cold War attack, you know, nuclear attack,
yeah,
people would be able to bunker down there. And also it was a jail at one point. So it's had many different guises. And interestingly, when I was researching, it said that some of the carpenters of the various years and iterations of the building have left either their mason marks or their signatures hidden, tucked away in floorboards and different places. So it really is a building of history, and it has had a lot of lifetimes before it was the music hall. And it's when it was a music hall, it had a main hall, which is kind of still used as part of the museum today. And from around 1835 to 2008, it was said to be one of the most popular places to go in Shropshire.
Fantastic. And
the original rules said, so this is the 1835 rules for the music hall, said that no children under 14, no smokers, no drunks, no spitters, no swearers or dirty folk were allowed in. So I would be kicked out instantly because I kick off a few of those and I've been a few more in my past. So and there was a... Pardon?
I said, and why not?
Yeah, why not? So I'd be kicked out at the door. Yeah. So there was rules. There was a certain standard. And it seems to straddle its place between being a place of kind of less repute, shall we say, like a lot of music halls were during the time. Mm. And somewhere where they had things like concerts and a little bit more higher brow, but it certainly was seen as the place to be for a long, long period of its history.
Yeah.
And perhaps most famously in the 60s, the Beatles played there, which is very cool. And also you get quite a lot of prominent acts within that kind of music hall scene at the time. But also I mentioned that there was jail cells in the building.
Mm.
So it's said that these jail cells, prior to it being a music hall, it was only really a music hall from 1840, they were implemented to store prisoners awaiting trial at the courthouse. And that there were also some in the cinema, which is now part of the square. So really, it was a building that I think has had many lifetimes, all of which have been very interesting lifetimes. But it's always really, I think, the most important thing really to stress about Shrewsbury Music Hall is that it's always played an active role in the community from really its earliest inception. So from when it was a symbol of status for the wealthy William Vaughan and a kind of a symbol of envy through to its time as a jail or as, you know, all the different iterations, it has served the community.
Mm.
And it's also been a place where really I'd say some societal boundaries have crossed, because when I looked at kind of, I did a search in the British newspaper archives, and equally you get reports of quite salubrious activities going on and people being drunk and disorderly, but then a musical performance of some of the classical music or something like that. So it's certainly a bit atypical to some of them, other music halls in the country, because you do get that double life of it, really. And I suppose it's a building of having so many lives that this is just one part of it. And really, rather interestingly, it's said to be haunted. And as so many music halls are, it's said to be haunted by the ghost of a dandy. I love the idea of dandies. I'd love to be one myself.
Yeah.
But this dandy was said to be seen standing right at the stage and constantly flicking his face with a white handkerchief. And some people have suggested that it might be a bit of a lucky charm, or it might be that he's just a bit sweaty as a ghost. But it seemed that whenever he was seen, and this goes all the way back to when it was still a music hall and they were putting on productions, whenever this ghost was seen, the production would always go well. So, which is very interesting. And there's also a lady that's said to be seen, but not really much is described about her.
Mm-hmm.
Another really weird tale that I came across is that in the coffee house passage, which is the shop just next to the music hall, the walls bleed blood and an eerie voice shouts, "Go." I can't really find anything else about that. Mm-hmm. And thanks to Shroppymon for his wonderful article, which covered some of the ghosts of the music halls. But it seems to have some history to it that is being manifested in its ghosts. So it's got everything. It's got your dandy. It's got your bleeding walls. And I think what's interesting about it is that Shrewsbury has had many lives And when you look at Shrewsbury as a place, it's not the biggest town in the world. But every period of history has left its mark on the town. And I think that is being seen as a microcosm within the music hall.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And I suppose it's funny that the, you know, even in terms of the ghosts, the variety of ghosts that kind of rather appropriately pins itself to the building. And you were touching on the kind of that social aspect of the music hall, and also the transition through time, because the music hall was transient, and at its height really was kind of the 1850s right through to the start of the Edwardian era. And kind of by the time the First World War came back, things changed. But we can talk about that more as we sort of move along. But this idea of the social hierarchy and within music halls, because I suppose, so if we go back really to kind of the story of the music hall, which is that they go back to coffee houses, things like this, the 18th century, and you would have what was sort of, I suppose, known as catches, and you had maybe the slightly more salubrious glee clubs. And you also had the pleasure gardens, because, of course, the pleasure gardens, which have been going for centuries, a bit like the kind of the bathhouses in a way, were somewhere to take the air and things like that. But also there would be entertainment on, of singing songs and things like this. But, of course, wherever you've got probably something with the name pleasure in it anyway, but you've got something where people are supposed to spend time as an enjoyment kind of recreational. You also have a mix of people, presumably a lot of the time younger women, younger men, things like this, mixing, and al fresco. You've also got music. I think bawdy lyrics are never far away, nor really is sex, and then sex is never far away, nor is the selling of sex. So these things quite quickly become less than salubrious. You can kind of see it. It's like a sort of, you know, a kind of rather raunchy Mary Beard recipe just kind of acted out. You can see all the ingredients that go to make this, and the music hall was no exception to that. But this idea of catches, which is why, of course, that we have the word catchy as we think of it today. So these are songs like Sam Hall is a very famous one, which is a song about a chimney sweep who's committed a murder, and he's going to be hanged the next day. And it sort of talks about the baying mob, and he says, "Damn you all," and all this lot. And he goes to Tyburn Hill, and it's a great old song, if anyone hasn't heard of it. And it was, I think somebody, I can't remember if it was the 70s or 80s, there was a kind of like a slightly sort of ska version of it that was quite good as well. But it's really famous, and Ronnie Drew, the Dubliners, did a version, all sorts. But that was a known as a catch, and it's when the song basically was quite catchy. And obviously, as I say, that's why we say catchy today. But then you would have, as these things became a little bit ruder, so you had lots of songs about, you know, looking up girl skirts and things like that. You would then get glee clubs, which were generally supposed to be a little bit more refined. But of course, what went on behind closed doors, no one knows. But by the kind of the 1830s, this idea of taverns and things having rooms that were devoted to musical clubs, which were, you know, like your standard sing song. They were known as free and easies, which I kind of love. But
I love that.
I know, isn't it? And it's been my motto. I mean, it hasn't, I'm joking, but it's, I'm like the total opposite of that. I'm just there at home researching musicals. Oh, it's the free and easy, huh? laughing at our own jokes. But also these things kind of picked up in popularity. And then, of course, like anywhere, it became sort of gentrified. So in the early days, and actually going into the 1880s as well, these were rooms, you know, sort of moving into theatres and things like that, that were heated. So the poor would go in there en masse, and you would have this thing, and I love this, and wet money is still a phrase, sounds a bit pervier than it is, but it really is just a phrase for money. That there was all these kind of rules around when you could sell a booze and things like that, and so they would have, and the kind of the exchange of money for alcohol. So you would have, I mean, they weren't, you know, speakeasies like America, but you would have this idea of going in and parting with money for tokens, a bit like a casino, I suppose. And then you could exchange these casinos for money. And it was known as wet money. And when that wet money ran out, you were sort of politely, in inverted commas, kind of pressured, shall we say, by waiters to purchase more tokens or piss off, basically. And so, you know, wherever you've got a room or a very large room full of booze and people and shows, you know, when you watch these shows, you think of people kind of cheering on supportively. It was not always the case. And there are theatres where they stood up in the balcony and things in the gallery, and then they basically pissed over the top, you know, and they threw things. And there was an anecdote. I know, I knew you'd love that. And there's an anecdote in Glasgow where this historian was talking about the musicals and things, and she was saying that you can tell the stars up there because it had a very old theatre in Glasgow that's being done up. And they found buttons, and they were trouser buttons, fly buttons. And they were saying either they'd undone it to have a pins or something kind of natural, but maybe not appropriate to the situation. And there was also a card they found. I can't remember the doctor's name, but there was a doctor, basically a doctor for venereal disease. So card and some buttons. It's like, come on, mate. Bloody hell, you want to be a bit more, just carry a sign, have a lanyard. but it was just, I thought that was fantastic. So, you know, you had this sort of idea of middle class clientele moving into the century because there was hot food, entertainment, and these would go on from 6 p.m. right up till kind of beyond midnight. And then in America, you had more of the sort of the vaudeville thing, variety acts. We've got tavern saloons, all these supper rooms, which I love. And then they basically, you know, they throw old bottles, old boots, in some instances, dead cats.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I know. And in industrial towns, the favoured object was an iron rivet. So yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. And also the other bit that is interesting is bottles were often carried to waiters that would change the tray because people would use them as like as missiles to the orchestra and things like that, but also steal booze. I mean, these lot were feral. They also had instances where women were allowed, but they would sort of have to sit back and sort of almost like be veiled and hidden. And often they would sit in supper rooms and things. But you know, the early days, it wasn't always accompanied by a pianist because you had to find a pianist. And a lot of very skilled pianists were often women, and women were not allowed to play the piano in such situations. And it was kind of well into the 19th century before women were kind of allowed to play piano sort of publicly in situations like that. I mean, it did happen because you would have women that kind of just didn't really give a shit, you know, and did it anyway. But it was really, really frowned upon. And in fact, one thing I thought was absolutely fascinating, just kind of passing from the cock to the cow bit here, was that the first royal variety performance, which was on in 1912 in July at the Palace Theatre. So by then, kind of variety had definitely got the royal seal. But what I thought was absolutely wonderful was Vesta Tilly, who is one of my favourites. So I'll go a little bit later on, I'll go into some of the big names. But Dan Leno and Vesta Tilly both played, and the Russian ballerina, who's very famous, Anna Pavlova. But Vesta Tilly came on dressed as a boy, as was her routine, basically. Male impersonator, that's what she was famous for. And Queen Mary looked sort of mortified and hid her face in her programme so as not to look, because of how embarrassed she was when Vesta Tilly came on dressed as a man. Because, of course, at that point, it was, you know, women did not, pre-World War One, were really not supposed to appear in public in trousers. So the idea of a kind of female impersonator, male impersonator. Now, I mean, vice versa, they did both, but a male impersonator was more unusual and almost sort of more scandalous because, of course, men had played women for years in Shakespeare and things like this. But the idea of a woman coming on singing bawdy songs, singing songs about young women and, you know, while demonstrably a woman and dressed as a man was sort of, I suppose, a little titivating and also just scandalous as well. So Vesta Tilly really was, you know, nowadays you'd be like, well, what's the big deal? But that really was a kind of, you know, a real mover of that sort of thing in her time. She was a powerhouse, really. But it's kind of setting the scene of what these old places were. And some of the most famous early musicals, The Eagle in London, which is on City Road, and Mary Lloyd, who's one of the big names of the Shrewsbury musical, of all musical, I should say, of the Shrewsbury musical. I don't know if she ever went there. I wouldn't have thought. I mean, she was huge. I mean, big, big star. And she appeared there when she was 14 in the 1880s. And eventually the Salvation Army bought it and then it was demolished as well. But there's still, what the interesting thing about that is actually that there's still a pub there called the New Eagle. So it's put on the same site and it has a displays of old music hall prints and things. So you can still go and have a look. And I love that. And another one that was very famous is the Canterbury Hall in Lambeth, which I absolutely love. And I suppose going on, I'm, like I say, I'm kind of passing around quite a lot, but looking at people that were very famous. Of course, Charlie Chaplin, huge. And in 1907, he was 17, and he made a solo comedy debut at a music hall in Cambridge Heath Road. And he never kind of lost that sort of music hall, you know, that kind of stayed with him as it was sort of starting his career. And a lot of these, I think, are people, you know, one thing actually just saying in terms of the people of the music hall is that, you know, there is a former prime minister of ours whose dad was a very famous music hall star. Did you know that?
Is there? No, I didn't. Who's that?
Probably the least likely of all. But then when you say, you go, oh, makes sense. John Major, John Major's dad.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I know that.
From you because I knew that you'd be really excited when you heard.
Yeah, that's well cool.
To tell you. And I've kind of like, I've known about it for a while and I've just never sort of thought it was going to mention it. And then when we decided to do this episode, I was like, oh, don't tell her about that because it's really funny. Yeah, Tom Major Ball. And he had his first wife, Kitty Grant, was a very famous music hall star as well, who's not John's mum. He married later in life and he was about 60 when he had John Major. But his wife, Kitty Grant, his first wife, was killed by a piece of falling equipment actually in a theatre, which is rather sad.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that is sad.
But Tom Major Ball was a very, very famous music hall star, and a lot of people when he was dying came to visit him, and John Major remembers them, and they would discuss, you know, the original music hall stars, Mary Lloyd, all this lot. And he has such good memories, and he wrote a very, very interesting book which I read years ago, and I just cannot encourage enough that people read it, called My Old Man. It was published about 10 years ago, I think, more probably. It's fantastic, and it is an encyclopedia of music hall knowledge. And, you know, I never thought I'd be here waxing lyrical about the Tories, but I will say, as Tories go, he has written a very interesting book. I think it's fantastic. It's very, very good. And I suppose lastly, before we kind of pass on, because I'm going on a bit here, I will mention Lily Langtry, who is one of my favourites. She is fantastic. And Lily Langtry was from Jersey, and they called her the Jersey Lily. And she was a long standing mistress of Edward the VII. And he famously, this is a very famous statement, and I really hope it's true. I think it likely is, because she was a known wit as well. And there is a pub named after her in London near Brompton, I think. I've been there. And he famously said to her that he'd spent enough on her to buy a battleship. And she retorted that he'd spent enough in her to float one. I thought, I will never be that funny. I was like, God, Lily, you are a card. Yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it? So it's like the last, yeah, absolute sass. And the last bit of trivia, probably in terms of people, is about Daisy Bell, which is actually written about Daisy, the Countess of Warwick, who was very famous at the time, was a hugely wealthy, very famous socialite, and later a liberal who did a lot for raising awareness about poverty and things like that. But at a height of sort of fame, she was very beautiful. And again, she was a mistress of the royals. And the song Daisy Bell is thought to have been written about her. Seems very likely that it was. She was also called the Babbling Brook because when she wrote her memoirs, she wrote really quite candid memoirs to make some money when she'd sort of spent her fortune later in life. And why not, frankly?
Yeah, kiss and tell. Tell everything.
I mean, I'm never going to be cool enough to be able to do that and then have also a musical song written about me. I mean, you know, do what you want, Daisy. And we still have a song today, so there you go. Right, go on then, Amy. What have you got next for us?
I think what's really interesting listening about it is kind of the several things. I think it's that it was a space for quite often the working classes to just have fun.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's, when you think about Victorian Britain and elsewhere, you particularly when you think about the working class and kind of your lower middle class, and I suppose even your underclasses, is the idea of how, well, shit life was, to be honest.
Yeah.
Is how difficult, how marred by tragedy and difficulty life was. So these buildings, these spaces, it was a celebration of life. It was an ability to let their hair down and enjoy themselves. And I think that's what's so wonderful and unique about these spaces is, yes, they were chucking bottles at the orchestra. But I've been to metal concerts, heavy metal concerts, and they're doing similar. So you can't really fault them. You know, I went to one where they were ripping up chairs and throwing them at the. So it's not like it is specifically just because they were poor that they decided to bottle the orchestra. It's human behavior. They're letting their hair down and they're enjoying themselves. And I think that's what's really interesting. Particularly as well, when you think about some of the stereotypes and how these buildings were viewed by what I affectionately, with air quotations, like to refer to as polite society. Yeah. I'm doing the air, obviously we're not on video, but I'm doing the air quotations as well, because as we all know, polite society often isn't polite behind closed doors. But
no. So
many of criticisms of the musical focus on them focusing on counterculture values such as bawdiness, hedonism, sensuality, and the enjoyment of alcohol, which all sounds like a good fun to me. And this idea that they're this paragon of sin and these areas where, because there is a group of working class people together, that it's inherently sinful. And I think it's interesting, even when you think about women, it was interesting noting when you said that in the early days, women kind of were almost sat to one side, veiled and hidden away from the men, because for a long period of its history in Shropshire and in Britain, if a woman was to go to the musical, it was automatically assumed she was a prostitute. Yeah. When I was doing a little bit of wider research, it was said that it was only really in those kind of major outlying industrial centres such as Manchester, Glasgow, Leeds and Birmingham where the presence of a woman was tolerated, and she was allowed to kind of spend her wages on that entertainment if she chose to. But in London, for instance, if she didn't have a male escort, she was a prostitute.
Yeah.
And I think all these kind of stereotypes of this inherently sinful, bawdy, raucous place really links to some of the earlier traditions that we see in theatre and even things like ballads and these kind of traditions where you find working people, mummers' plays, even when, if we stretch all the way back, when we see groups of people who maybe are working class enjoying themselves. So reading about and listening to you talk about the kind of stereotypes about the music hall, it reminded me of even far back in the 1600s, the way things like mummers plays and Morris dancing was seen as this means of kind of getting drunk, getting a bit of money and letting your hair down kind of thing. But also, there's a story in Shrewsbury that comes directly from the Puritan tradition. It's first written down around 1703, and it was in a Welsh source, but it was translated later at this point in its history. But it's said to have happened around 1663. And this was when the devil came to Shrewsbury.
Yeah.
So obviously, I don't exactly hide it very much anymore. I'm rather obsessed with the devil, but which is not something that probably an RE teacher should say, but I love the folklore of the devil, the folkloric devil, not the Satanist devil. He doesn't interest me at all. I'm not a Satanist. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's not for me. But this is perhaps one of my favourite devil pieces of devil folklore in Shropshire, and it's said that the devil turned up in Shrewsbury at one of the theatres and made himself visible. He went and he started watching a performance of Dr. Faustus. Now, what's brilliant, we'd get slightly different variations of the story, but it basically, the idea is the devil turns up at this theatre and starts watching Dr. Faustus, realizes that the guy playing him is doing a terrible job, and decides, you know what, I can do a better job at being the devil than him. And he takes on the role of himself in the theatre play.
Oh, ego.
And it's said that he is so good at playing himself. He turns all these sinners from their pleasure to their prayers, and everyone flees from the theatre, and they go straight to church because they're so shocked and appalled by this evil devil-like character, when in reality it was the devil himself. And I love this story on a surface level because it's got the devil literally being an egomaniac, like, no one can do this better than me. I'm me. I'm going to do it. I'm going to write the theme tune, and I'm going to act in it, star in it, direct it, that kind of thing. But also, I love it because it shows how, in the Puritan tradition, theatre is seen as inherently sinful. It is something that only the devil could enjoy, and only people who have fallen, like your prostitutes and your alcoholics and all of those people that are inherent sinners, it's only something that they would go to. No one else would go to a theatre but them. And then if we look at it within our discussion of the music hall, you're getting these same comments 200, 300 years later, 400 years later, when we look at the 19th and 20th century, and that real switch of the height of the music hall is that it's still seen for being a place where working class people meet and enjoy themselves. It's still seen as being a sinful or a place where there will be promiscuous dancing, to quote one source, and sin. So I just think it's really fascinating to look at this building in the context of other performing arts and see how it is really joining the same tradition.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? So interesting. And I think it's, you know, these kind of messages are sort of occurring in the songs that they sing as well. So, like, if you look at... I'm going to say all these, like, they're so, so famous. But, I mean, they are still, but it's just funny. She said, like, they're catchy, like, modern songs. But this is, and actually, I'm going to be honest, my running playlist is largely made up of songs like this. And I'm not trying to sound like the edgy weird girl. Like, honestly, I just love stuff like this. And I'm too old to be the edgy weird girl. Anyway, I'm just weird. But Mary Lloyd, there's a very a great old song by Fred W. Lee and George Arthurs. And in 1915, they wrote, "A little bit of what you fancy does you good." And it's all sung in these kind of Cockney accents and things. And Mary Lloyd made it very, very famous. And a lot of these were kind of morale boosters. You know, like you had Daisy, like I keep saying, Daisy Bell. And these were kind of reminders that people didn't have to spend a lot of money on weddings. I do like to be beside the seaside, like these kind of feelings. And I know recently, actually, there was a piece talking about Maybe It's Because I'm a Londoner, which is again, another old song. But actually, in recent times, kind of people have felt like a unity with that, especially like in lockdown, things like that. There was this kind of surge of interest in old songs that kind of boosted morale in the way that they had done during the war as well, with kind of like Any Old Arm, that sort of thing, Long Way to Tipperary. And of course, Boiled Beef and Carrots is one that's kind of, you know, has got these sort of lyrics where it says it's, you know, it's good for your Darby Curl, which Darby Curl is Cockney rhyme slang for belly. You know, they had these songs that were sort of quite cheerful, me old mugger kind of, you know, slap on the back. But they also had some old songs which carried meanings. You know, when you mentioned the polite society, in inverted commas, you know, you've got a song that I think of all the time, and I always, this is one of those I always hum and sing to myself as well, but it's The Same the Whole World Over, which is such a brilliant old song. And it's about a girl who's very pretty, moves to London, loses her maiden name because the guy's sort of, you know, a gentleman, in inverted commas, chats her up. She gives up the goose, and you know, she, spoiler, basically, it's very sad at the end. She sees that he's in a carriage with a more suitable woman, in inverted commas. And she jumps off the bridge. And it's kind of done in that tongue-in-cheek Victorian way, because they say when we pulled her from the water, or dragged her from the water, differing versions, water from her clothes they wrung. And they thought that she had drowned it, because they love to do that, thought that she had drowned it. Yeah. Their word. I feel like I should put in brackets sick, acknowledging that that's a mistake. But yeah, when they thought that she had drowned it, her corpse got up and sung and then says it's the same the whole world over. It's the poor what gets the blame and all this kind of thing. And it's, you know, it's an absolute old classic. And another, of course, which just everybody must know in some degree. And I can't remember. I've been singing it for years. And my sister said, I think, was it on Breaking Bad or something? I was singing. She's like, oh, that was on or something. It's My Darling Clementine. It's a real old one.
Yeah.
It's a blinder, isn't it? I love that one.
Yeah.
And, he says, and I always get to sing, I'm not going to sing, it's on the podcast, but he says at the start, in a cavern in a canyon, excavated for a mine, dwelt a miner 49er and his daughter Clementine. And that 49 is a reference to the 1849 gold rush as well. So, yeah, it's cool, isn't it? And there's a bit, and he says, on a hillside in a churchyard where the myrtle doth entwine, there grow roses, sometimes posies, made of flowers for Clementine. And they go on like lovely, nice verses. But one of my favourites is, in my dreams she still doth haunt me, dressed in garb soaked in brine. How in life I used to hold her, now she's dead, I draw the line. And I'm just going to say for the benefit of the listeners, I am not reading these lyrics. I've known this song for years. Of course, you know, there's other classics, like at the end when he says, how I missed her, how I missed her, how I missed my Clementine. Then I kissed her little sister, quite forgot my Clementine. You're like, yeah, handy.
Yeah.
You know, he talks about love, but in a way that is clearly sort of slightly taking the piss. But these were all themes that would have been familiar to the Victorians and to us today. You know, when people go, I'm heartbroken, heartbroken. Oh, a little sister's all right, isn't she? Oh, okay, fine. Sorry, Clem who?
What? Yeah, yeah.
And when he says, you know, there was all these kind of fairly elusive lyrics, like saying, light she was, just like a fairy, her shoes were number 9, so she had big feet, and so much so that
same,
she had
hair,
you know, hair and boxes without topses, made the shoes for Clementine because her feet were too big to have shoes and things like this. You know, it's all kind of like tongue in cheek, just saying, like, because she's obviously a tall woman. And he says that she stumped her foot upon a splinter, fell into the foaming brine, and then, you know, ruby lips above the water. Basically goes on to say that he could have saved her, but alas, I was no swimmer, so I lost and it also then comes like the joke of, did he push her, didn't I, all this stuff. And then you've got like, you know, I'm Henry the Eighth, I am, and you know, we kind of think, oh, the Tudor monarchs, like, no, just the eighth man called Henry that she'd married, you know. And there's all these wonderful old songs, and you know, Champagne Charlie is my name, and The Boy I Love is up in the gallery, and some of them have got kind of questionable ability to rhyme and sort of are not always that great in terms of lyrical genius, but they're sort of, they've got this affection and this message. And I think, you know, the other side, of course, is just purely that it was a bit of a peep show as well, because you've got the Can-Can and Offenbach's obviously famous music. And in fact, actually, there was a very famous musical star, heard the Can-Can had been in England for a while, and then she'd been in America and heard Tirada Boom Die, which is huge, isn't it? It's very, very famous. And she came back, brought it back to London and was like, right. And so you would start by flashing a bit of ankle, then a bit of knee, and then right up. And the main thing about Can-Can girls, of course, which very often gets overlooked, is that their bloomers, as we know historically, are crotchless. They just cover the leg. So yeah, there was a lot of kicking your ankle up in the air with
it.
Yeah, you see what I mean? So you're seeing a bit more than their, yeah. And that was a big kind of part of the show. And there were situations where they kind of wore maybe knickers more that we would see today with frilly bits in the back and things like that. That is often what is projected to us. But actually, a lot of the time, they wore these big pants and things that lift up their skirt. And you, the whole kind of part of it was that you saw that. And they were able to sort of lift their legs way higher than I would ever be able to do. And there's a fantastic, I think we'll put it on our socials, actually. There's a fantastic video that I've just watched so many times because, you know, that's just how I roll of an evening. And it's the musical, and this chap's holding his top hat. It's very old footage, and the girls just go kicking this hat, and it's incredible. I mean, he's holding it probably taller than I am, and you know I'm not very tall, but I kind of, it must be about five, like I'm 5'3", so it's got to be about five, whatever it is. And I mean, these are quite tall women flicking their leg like right up to kick this hat, and it's, you know, kind of peeping vaginas aside, it's yeah, there's a sentence you didn't think you'd hear. We're talking about merches. Peeping vaginas aside, you've got this athleticism, and you know, we were talking about like the bawdiness of these. These singers had some serious brass, like brass neck, rather than just money. I mean, actually going on to money, they earned a fortune as well, but some of them. But like the courage to be in there while shit's getting thrown at you. Like it'd be like the kind of, I suppose, like you said, like Faust to say Christopher Marlowe, it'd be like the plays of their day. You know, we're not talking about like John Gielgud with his beautiful voice being kind of like, you know, sitting while everyone interviews him saying, isn't he charming? These are people getting told to like off and all this stuff and having pissed, like, you know, from the balcony. So, you know, the big stars, the big names were the ones that really kind of absolutely just have deserved it, because I tell you, they must have put up with so much stuff. And you have people even now kind of going into the more modern era, like Tommy Cooper, Stanley Holloway, a lot of people would have known as well. Mrs. Miller, the pianist, she was ace. Morecambe and Wise, Ken Dodd. You know, they were kind of the end of the era of the music hall, which I'll talk more about afterwards. But even Alexei Sale, the comedian, like his kind of early stuff was quite...
I love him.
He's very cool, isn't he? And, you know, you were talking about mumming, like, you know, mum's the word. We get that because it was sort of like the father of mime, really. And it was kind of synonymous with silence, and so mum's the word was kind of the message was from the play. And Alexei Sale's kind of early stuff has this kind of miming, mockery kind of musical quality to it. And I know that he's a fan of the musical, but even costermongers, like the, you know, in the 19th century, was all kind of their calls that they would have. And I suppose the best example of that for a lot of people is that theatrical song in Oliver, Who Will Buy, which is a slightly romanticised version of costermongers, but a lot of them ended up having sort of really squawky, weird voices as they got old because they knackered their voice boxes, because they would sing in varying degrees on the street to generate the interest. And people would often go there to places like that, like Borough Market, just to kind of hear them. Because, and Billinggate, you know, because they wanted to hear their calls, because it was entertainment in itself. And in fact, actually, there were costermongers that went on to be musical stars as well. And other ones that are famous, like Little Titch, I mentioned the money, famously said that he was wealthier than the Prime Minister. And they could bring in sort of £120 a week, things like that, which could be almost like the equivalent of like 20 grand. It's a lot.
So, that's like, an awful lot.
There was a lot of poverty as well. There was a lot of mistreatment of people as well. But some of the big names that did it, like Mary Lloyd, people like that, really could really command a price. And in fact, she didn't do the 1912 Royal Variety because she had a famous wink and some people thought she might be a little bit bawdy. So she put on a show a bit further down the road and it sold out. It was fantastic. So Mary Lloyd kind of, because what was interesting really about this idea of the Royal Variety making it more salubrious was that they sort of had a hired audience, really, a very polite people. So you didn't get the camaraderie of the musical in its truest sense. And the performance by Mary Lloyd, she said, it said, Mary Lloyd is a command performance by order of the British public. So she's obviously taking the piss out of the royals there as well, which, you know, she did really well. And I love her. And I've been to see her grave. You can actually go and see it. It's in West Hampstead. It's, yeah, she's a legend and people still put flowers on it. Of course, she was one of the best.
I love that. I love the idea of these people being so kind of synonymous with their generation and synonymous with the music hall and their talent and their craft, that we still have people visiting and, you know, putting flowers on their grave. And I think that's what's so fascinating about the arts in general, is that even after their initial relevancy has died out, you will always have people finding them. There will always be people that are drawn to the exuberance and the glamour and the contrasted with the spit and sawdust and the bottles flowing and that kind of thing. There'll always be people drawn to it exactly the same as there was 100 years ago. And, you know, I think as we've kind of, certainly in my lifetime, there was an element of, you know, you have to be a certain way and you can't have all these weird and wonderful interests. But you know what? It's brilliant. And it's brilliant to know that there are people out there that see the relevancy of this still and that are celebrating someone that, you know, a century or nearly a century has passed between them being here and not. And I think, you know, it's just exciting to know that there are more kind of weird theatre kids and weird, you know, people with weird interests still that, oh, you know, what are you going to do? We were talking a little bit about this before we started recording, because I love medieval churches and I love churches, and I don't particularly know why I love churches because I'm not a Christian, but I love churches and I love the fact there are people out there with equally, you know, weird and wonderful interests. It's like, what did you do this weekend? Oh, well, I went to a musical star's grave and left flowers. Excellent. That is the energy I want to celebrate. It's wonderful. Absolutely love it.
Yeah, I think that's so kind of yeah, relevant and interesting. And I think people love it for lots of different reasons. And I think that was always the sort of the nuance of it and the idea of it. And I think it's repurposed and it's reclaimed like things always are. Like, you know, whether you get kind of, you know, Gen Z taking low cut jeans off us from the early noughties and we're like, mate, as a generation that moved on to mum jeans, I'm very happy for you to, you know, never see those again. They're dreadful. But, you know, the musical did the same thing where it inspired generations after that and people hummed the songs, they loved the songs, it became part of the vernacular, it became part of life. You know, there were a handful of, you know, more than that of theatres and things in London, but there were about 400 odd musicals. It was huge. And
wow,
it went across,
yeah,
you know, across the country. These were household celebrity names. These were things that people knew and went on to do. And it's interesting, you know, when you've got the character songs and they were about kind of, you know, working life, being working and all mother-in-laws, which was a kind of a trope that went well into the 70s, like Bernard Manning, people like that, like, you know, not my style of comedy, but still jokes that were, you know, very much in the kind of 60s, 70s, very popular sort of style of jokes. You know, songs and things about like bailiffs, overdue rent, things like that, that a lot of Irish folk songs also encompass. Drink debts, unfaithful wives, so, you know, husbands that are cuckolded, henpecked husbands by contrast. You know, so either you're, you know, a beautiful young mistress and you're a bit slutty, this is the man's view, or you're a henpecking wife, you know, it's... whatever, it's, you know, you can't really win, I think, is the theme for most women. And I think it's interesting that women within that created their own role, making fun of men, you know, like singing My Old Man to Follow Van, Don't Dilly Dally on the Way. And, you know, this is about Moonlight Flit to avoid paying rent, basically. So a lot of people still sing it now, but it's a song about moving on to another house to dodge paying the rent because the dad couldn't make the rent. You know, and so these are all kind of unashamedly like East End working songs that, that just really kind of left London, went right through the country, that everybody sort of fell in love with, but have kept that sort of core of musical about them, that every time someone goes to sing them, you kind of find yourself putting on a bit of a Mockney accent.
Yeah.
Like I do, and I'm like, oh, it's the same, the old world over, you're like this, and it's, you know, you're all kind of like, all right, me old man. And they don't talk.
At least yours is better than mine.
Is it?
I debuted mine a few episodes ago and I'm still cringing about it. It's
Sorry, yeah. I just did. It's fine. I'll be like, well, you know, we get off. I'm like, oh, end session. I'm like, oh, God, Alex, why did you do that? This is basically this, my life, everything I say. but they do, you know, what I love about this as well is always the irony of the musical, which is deliberate, with the unashamedly patriotic, sentimental, true love. You know, my old mother, idyllic villages, you know, they came from some idyllic village, moved to London and got kind of, you know, screwed over and these sort of things. But they knew what they were doing. It's like William Blake writing Jerusalem. You know, these were actual ways of delivering really quite poignant social messages that people in the audience absolutely resonated with, completely related with it. You know, it was there. And we've kind of taken it as the glory age of music hall and made it this kind of like sentimental thing. But actually the reality of it was escapism whilst kind of laughing at your misfortune, because what else could you do? You know, and they really took the piss out of the upper echelons as well, like the upper classes who went there largely to pick up women and various things. But they took the chronic piss out of those people and made a lot of money off those people as well. I'm quite right, frankly. And, you know, variety by the early kind of 20th century, that there were, in fact, purpose-built theatres. So like the Empire of the Palaces, the Alex, things like this, or Edwardian theatres, big chandeliers, like beautiful gold decorations, velvet seats, all this kind of thing. A kind of more synonymous really with the Edwardian age, some of the Victorian, but more 1880s onwards. You know, this kind of idea of the height of the Victorian musical as we would imagine a musical is largely aesthetically an Edwardian style, because it didn't always have that grandeur and the traditional sort of eating and drinking at the performance. What is interesting as well is the idea of having an ice cream at the theatre at the interval, which is dates well over 100 years. That's been going on for a long time and we still do it today. Certainly if I ever go and see things at the theatre or, you know, Shakespeare, whatever it is, you're kind of, you know, halfway through Winter's Tale and then you go and get a Magnum. It kind of feels like an interesting contrast, but, you know, why not? But I think that kind of the old spirit of the music hall as we recognised it was replaced increasingly by variety. And then you had the Royal Variety Performance, which kind of was the birth of an ever-changing style. And then you had the war, and really it probably feels like, you know, just because I'm going on so much, but a relevant time, I suppose, by, you know, the start of the Second World War. you know, these the songs kind of became more and more patriotic. And Vesta Tilly actually was known for kind of one of the main kind of people for signing up soldiers because of her sort of patriotic approach to things and morale, and people kind of, you know, they felt positive about really what was a very bleak time. But after the war, so much had changed, and that kind of golden age of music hall really was fading. And of course you had things like cinema coming in, so that changed as well, and television was not so far behind in the scheme of things, and radio of course as well. So things started to change, and what people wanted, and increasingly people wanted special effects. So anybody putting on plays and things like that wanted things that shocked them, in a way that the music hall had started to lose revenue, and it started to become old hat. And of course its greatest stars were becoming old, you know, as well.
Yeah, so yeah,
no longer had, I mean, I think they probably still did have the same vigor, but the world was changing, and I think women had kind of had jobs and things through the war, so I think things were just starting to change, and the idea of a woman wearing trousers was not quite the shock that it had once been. And I think that idea of things being sort of quite decadent and over the top, and you know, it was all kind of being seen as a little bit bad taste, until maybe sort of, you know, the 20s had become trendier. They were into jazz and things like that. And so, I don't know why I said that, boys. They're into jazz.
Jazz. Hello and welcome to Jazz Podcast.
Welcome to the shop to jazz.
I don't know anything about jazz, so I can't be on a jazz podcast.
I'd be like, oh, jazz. that's really tickled me. But, you know, it changed, and to a point that really the nostalgia for it didn't come back until probably about the kind of 60s, when there was this sort of renaissance of interest in, and you had some old performers putting on some shows and things like that, and some audience that would have still remembered the music hall going along. And in fact, there was a documentary with the brilliant James Mason, I can't do his voice, but he's a very good actor, long dead, but I loved him. In the Water Babies, actually, he was great. And he did a documentary called The London Nobody Knows in 1967. And that is fascinating. And he goes to an old music hall. And it's quite moving, actually. And there's another one made in 1968 called A Little of What You Fancy. And yeah, it's almost quite sad to see, because these empty places, apart from the Wilton, which has been restored, and one in Glasgow has been restored, there are still, you know, some about, but others have had a change of use, like Shrewsbury, and others just simply have sat empty and have, you know, probably will do for, you know, many years to come. And it's, you know, some are listed. Probably there should be more that are protected, but you know, I know there's things in place trying to look after these old buildings, but yeah, it's sad. These once sort of beautiful, amazing buildings that were full of life have kind of, in some instances, disappeared to the peace super time. But you know, look, that said, that, like I said, there are charities and things in place that look after and are trying to get things like this going again. But you know, it's, as with everything that's going on in the world, you know, it's how much of a priority does that need to be? I would say very much so, but they might go, cost of living crisis. Do you know what I mean? Let's not too much. But yeah, I mean, is there anything you wanted to add?
I think it's interesting thinking about the legacy of these buildings and the legacy of what happened in them. I think it's interesting what you were saying about how these stereotypes and these archetypes is probably the proper word of the performances were still being mirrored in the 70s and the 80s with some of the and interesting with people like Alexei Sayle. They were seen as very cutting edge in comedy. They were seen as doing something very different and very almost, you know, they were, I'm thinking of the Young Ones and that kind of thing, that generation, but its origins were in the music hall. And I think their legacy should be definitely more known about and shared, and that these buildings and the events that took place in them are such an important, special piece of working class history that they're so deserving of the attention that, you know, when you said that you wanted to do an episode on musicals, I was so excited, because even though I didn't know too much about them, it's such a deserving thing to be discussing and talking about, and the amount of joy that must have happened within these buildings and how much release they must have given from the stresses of the day-to-day life. It's so valid and worthwhile talking about them. And, you know, I think still to this day, when we even see things like melodramas and when you get on to kind of like your soaps, I've never really watched them since Phil Mitchell was an alcoholic, but things like EastEnders and things still are very much playing up to some of the things you see in the musical, those tropes of like the nagging wife, like you said, and the mother-in-law that's interfering. These are all still seen on our TV today in our soaps. So it's really interesting to look at how the arts, because I do think the musical is very much part of the arts, these and how they continue today. And, you know, when you do see theatre and, you know, soaps, I think, are a great example of it. When you look at soaps, they're so melodramatic and they're so tongue-in-cheek that you look back and you think, well, yeah, actually, this is where the music hall has continued. They might not be singing My Old Man's a Dustman and, you know, on a stage, but it's still relevant to this day. And I think perhaps we can all learn a little bit of something from the music hall, and perhaps we do need more than ever, I think, post-COVID, escapism with the arts, and that the arts, our local theatres, all the way through to our national ones, are deserving of the funding that they get and are deserving of their place. We are so lucky to have a very, very long legacy of these kind of buildings and these kind of institutions that we should celebrate that. So I think it is so important to look at their unseen histories and also how important things like a music hall or a theatre can be to a person, and how incredibly lucky we are to have, even though it's, you know, going through its own funding crisis, an arts, cultural kind of world within Britain today. So I feel we're very lucky to have this long tradition and to be able to look back at some of the greats like Mary Lloyd and Arthur Roberts and kind of say, actually, no, they are still relevant today.
Yeah, I love that. And I think you're absolutely on the money, you know, and I think people still buy, you know, and Champagne Charlie, that's still a phrase. And I think people still buy these kind of prints to hang up in their flats and houses and things. And you've got that very famous kind of George Laybourne as a kind of Champagne Charlie with his fantastic kind of Piccadilly Weepers, which, by the way, if people don't know, those hugely long kind of sideburns, so beyond mutton chops, but look like we're almost like fluffy wings. And also, like, within that, you've got your Piccadilly Windows, which is like your slang for a monocle, which I love that as well. So,
oh, I like that. I like that.
It's cool. So there's still kind of phrases that are musical era that kind of stay with us, you know, and that they had strikes, as a famous strike in 1907.
Yes.
The Holbein Empire, you know, like Holborn Empire. They were kind of very famous things. And on stage, I think you nailed it when you said about the soaps, because they looked on at their own. That's what they were doing. These people were their own. They'd come from Limehouse, from Isle of Dogs. They'd come from these places which had not been, you know, Deptford. They had not been gentrified at that point. And so, you know, there's no tea pigs or, like, you know, whatever else. These are kind of still, you know, impoverished parts of London. And they were looking on and seeing their own. And that's what we did, particularly in the kind of the early days of like EastEnders and actually Coronation Street, when you've got like Ina Sharples.
Yes.
And you've got the wonderful Elsie Tanner as well. You know, these are all people that people kind of recognised. And, you know, like when Elsie goes, hey, you're about ready for the knackers yard, Elsie. You know, people were looking at that kind of going, this is like seeing a bit of themselves. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think on the music hall, they were doing exactly that. And even as these stars got old, you kind of stayed this affection for them. And you mentioned, actually, interestingly, that you went off EastEnders when Phil was an alcoholic. I went off when, you know, they got Peggy, obviously, Barbara Windsor, bless her, the late, great Barbara Windsor passed away in life and wasn't well, so she had to leave EastEnders. But when they got rid of Pat as well, and there was a fantastic scene, I can't remember if we discussed this before, but she's sitting on the stairs.
Yes.
And she goes to it, says her ghost, and you just see this smoke. And then she says about her earrings, she goes, "What? I think I look fabulous." And she goes, "Yeah, you do." She says about her earrings, saying she's rattling like Marley's chains. Also the iconic scene of when Frank is like, "You're naked," which we are like, "Take my eyes." But, you know, he's all right, Pat. I don't know if you
all right, darling. Yeah. Oh, I honestly don't really watch much TV, but glory days of EastEnders, peak.
Iconic.
Pat Butcher is my icon. I literally, the bigger the earring, the closer you are to God, I think, personally. So I really have taken that on. If I could get away with wearing a massive leopard print fur coat, I would.
Oh, I think
she is queen. My favourite plotline of Phil Mitchell, because I'm rather fond of Phil Mitchell, was that he became an alcoholic, got over it, became a cokehead. I think he started taking cocaine, lived in the park, in the square, I should say. It's not the park.
It's very big.
And then he saved some puppies from dying. And that was really when I went to university and I stopped watching it. But that arc, you can't get an arc like that anywhere but a soap or possibly a musical. So yeah, big fan.
There's a musical of its day, like the plot twist, love that. And also like the EastEnders theme, everything. It's, you're exactly right. It's exactly that. And didn't the late Queen apparently watch Coronation Street? So again, it's one of those things that all walks of life are kind of watching this, and it's the musical of its day, and it's over the top, and it's full of, you know, things that would never happen. But, you know, wasn't the music hall exactly that? And I think, you know, you look at your Albert Chevalier, Harry Champion, you know, even George Formby, you know, when I'm cleaning windows, his dad was a music hall star, probably not so much of a surprise. Florrie Ford.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he was, yeah.
When I lived in Wigan, I lived not too far from where he was born. That's my claim to fame. Yeah, and there's a statue in the Grand Arcade in Wigan of George, and it's about your height. And every time I walked past it, I nearly bumped into it, and I would always go, "Oh, sorry, mate," and then I'd realise it was a statue.
You're like, "Oh, sorry. Oh, it's George Formby. It's fine." That's a good story. That's a good story. I love George Formby. And you can tell, like, you know, with his little ukulele, you can tell that his dad was a musical star. I think that feels like it's not a stretch. And, you know, they had great names as well. Like George Robey was very famous, and he was known as the Prime Minister of Mirth. You know, they had these great names, these great songs, things like that. And I just think they'll stay with us. They're kind of in our heart. And I think, you know, they've got a legacy that has not and probably will not ever fade. And I do think there is, you know, there's a kind of sexual message in everything. Like there's one called The Tuner by Piano Tuner, the tuner's opportunity, if you see what I mean. See what I did there?
Mm-hmm.
That's how he did it. Yeah, and it was all about a piano tuner that goes to tune a woman's piano, in inverted commas, three times a week. And it gets progressively more rude. And I think, look, man's kind of proclivity, and I say mankind rather than just men, but mankind's proclivity for sort of smutty songs or making something an innuendo or just like a good sing-along and kind of all joining in, it's still there. People still love it. And I think there is a sadness to seeing these amazing old buildings empty, forgotten, you know, broken into, whatever it may be, because they're fading beauties in some ways, because, you know, had anyone at that point known what might be waiting for them in 100 years' time, I doubt it. But, you know, for the ones that have been restored or repurposed or whatever it may be, like you said, of the Shrewsbury musical, they've got a new lease of life, and their relevance in the modern world, I think, is so, so vital. And they're a really key part of history, something beyond, you know, songs and slapping your thigh and dressing up as a bloke, whatever it may be. But even that, like I say, was emancipation. It was dressing up in a time that wasn't appropriate. It was shocking people. It was boundaries and that kind of, you know, the working man's hero. And in fact, Winston Churchill was a massive musical fan as well, although, you know, he wasn't always great. We know that. But there was a lot of walks of life that liked the musical, and they had real influence as well. They could sway things in terms of parliamentary acts, things like that, you know, because they'd say, if you wanted to know what they were talking about in Parliament, you'd go into the music halls and listen, because that's where they'd be taking the piss out of politicians and things like that. That's where all the gossip was. They knew everything, and it would all be on stage, ready to go. And so, if you wanted to know what the common man, in inverted commas, you know, you and I, what everyone of our kind of ilk thought it was going on in the music hall. So I think their influence is not to be underestimated. That's just like a bit of a jolly. They really did have this huge, huge influence for the best part of 100 years, really. And in fact, actually longer, because we're still talking about them and they're still something that people are familiar with. So from my point of view, I've long been obsessed, always will be. And even, you know, whether it's kind of Hinge and Bracket, Max Wall, all these lot that still have got that idea. I love it, always will. And I'm going to say as well, just while I remember, that I wanted to dedicate this episode to a little cat that we're a big fan of, and his name's Little Spoon. So
I love Spoon.
Love Spoon. I'm going to say, Little Spoon, if you've got this far, that this episode is dedicated to you, because you could have been a musical star.
You are a star.
You are a star. You're a Twitter star. Or X, whatever they're calling it now. But yeah, Little Spoon, this episode has been dedicated to you. So my last thing before I pass on to Amy, who's going to see us out because she does it in style, is to say that look for these songs, look for them on YouTube, Spotify, whatever it may be, because honestly, it's a kind of, you put your toe in the water and that's it. You jump in for a swim, because it is the most fascinating, wonderful thing. The songs are so catchy. As soon as you hear them, you feel good. I was humming and singing one when I was plugging in the mic and things like, they're addictive. And I hope the musical and its legacy goes on for a long time yet. So there you go.
Excellent. And I think I want to finish by saying that for so many strands of the Shropshire's Witches podcast is celebrating working people's histories and working people's legacies. And I think it's no different with the music hall. These places would have been a place of solace and relief and fun for so many groups of people. And they're incredibly important. So I think it's been so interesting digging a little bit deeper as someone that didn't necessarily know too much about their history and their culture. And it's been brilliant to hear not only the history of them, but your passion for them, Alex. But I want to finish completely on a question for you. So you are obviously our resident expert of music halls.
Yeah.
What would you say was your favorite song or piece of music hall music? And yeah, so what would you say would be your best, or if one's difficult, what's your top three?
Oh, tricky. So my favourite, I think, do you know what? That is really hard, because in terms of catchiness, Where Did You Get That Hat? Stanley Holloway's version, great. Where Did You Get That Hat? It's cracking. I absolutely, in terms of a song that I just have known since I was a little girl and have always loved, is Oh My Darling Clementine. And I think for one that encompasses the era, the sense of humour, it's, you know, and that slightly sort of tongue-in-cheek Victorian melodrama, it's got to be It's the Same the Whole World Over, because it just really is the epitome of the 19th century. And there is one more, if I can add four.
Yeah, go on, I'll let you.
Is one that actually apparently Mary Kelly was supposed to be heard singing the night she died as well, which always kind of made me quite sad, because I'd known the song for years and then I read that. But it's A Violet from Mother's Grave, which is quite a haunting old Victorian song, but was also sung in the music halls. But that's quite a moving one, A Violet from Mother's Grave. So look all of those up. They'll be available somewhere, possibly 150 years ago. But you know, those for me, the sort of the four songs that have really got the essence of the music hall, and the second you'll hear them, you'll kind of be, you know, transported back at least a century.
Excellent. So I'm definitely going to look at them. But listeners, that's your homework. As your resident teacher, that's your homework. You need to listen to them. And I want 500. No, I don't. But no, I really would recommend listening. And it's been so interesting to dig a little bit deeper. So thank you guys for listening. And thank you, Alex, for sharing all of your knowledge, because I've learned so much today, and I'm sure people at home will have too.
Thanks so much, guys. Thank you. Bye, bye, bye.
Bye, bye.
did you get that hat? Where did you get that tile? Isn't it a knobby one and just the proper style? I should like to have one just the same as that. Wherever I go, they shout, hello, where did you get that hat? Now, how I came to get this hat is very strange and funny. Grandfather died and left to me his property and money.